Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the oil crash and you right after this. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said that? He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he has to say about our nation's lawyers. He said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And it's worse than that. Most of the students who graduate from this law school do so without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax," unquote. Now, that was Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, and it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. I got a letter in here the other day from a listener. His name is Tate, and he says, "Hi, Mr. Gordon. The new higher bit rating of your files are just great. All the better to hear you with." I'll make a comment on that. We've got the quality control problem solved here. So our archives are at 32-bit. That's CD quality for radio station broadcasting. So if you'll click onto our website, georgegordon.org, and then go to the archives, you can pick up these programs, assuming that you're not satisfied with what you're hearing right now. And you can download it right on your computer, or you can download these files and then make your own CDs and send them to your friends. He said, "By the way, attaching a sheet made by Bruce Thompson of New Zealand, we plan to visit him in January of 2005 during our vacation. I thought you might find it interesting, and please pay special attention to the small chart near the end entitled Spurious Reserve Revisions." Now, what this is about is my series on peak oil. And I've done that a couple of times. You notice that oil is at $50 a barrel. Well, that's not an accident. And he goes on to say, "You know, I tried many times to publish or call attention to peak oil, and I called the American Chamber of Commerce here in Russia, and they have 900 multinational members, and this is the leading club in Moscow. They have an energy department. Do you know that the energy department co-chairs both said to me, peak what?" So now here's Russia. They're looking at this oil crisis, and they say, "What? Peak what?" "I was referred to a guy in London who made a statement in an email to me saying, in a paraphrase, British Petroleum does not see any correlation between production volumes and oil peaking." Now, that was in 2003. "Since then, in less than a year, people have started coming out and saying that we have problems. There is no more oil capacity." That's production capacity. Matthew Simmons, former energy advisor to George Bush, Dr. Campbell, Dutch Shell and Petro Consultants, 40 years in the industry, Dr. LaHare, 40 years in the industry, and 100 other names that I could go on and look up, more every day are coming to the conclusion the levee is breaking. So please jump on board and inform your listeners about the truth concerning peak oil. I love your show and I appreciate your service. My only complaint is that your take on peak oil is just not correct. Reserves are deliberately obfuscated and exaggerated to support short-term policies of the G-man and the corporate guys. And by the way, I serve them from my company. And I know some of these people, great people, but their agenda for success comes before their agenda for truth. That is their motivation. And he says, best regards, Tate. He put a postscript on here and he said that you will see that peak production on most countries has passed as well. Go over the peak, so go the country, so goes the world. The multinationals and the G-men want us all to believe that they will think of something. And most of us think this way because we are hydrocarbon man and we cannot imagine any other way of life. But populations will correct downwards into something much more like the Book of Revelation. These G-men he's talking about are the government men, politicians. Well, thank you, Tate. I think I'll put this on. Now, he's got about a, 10, 15-page treatise here. It begins by this headline that says, The Oil Crash and You. It was last week I paraphrased this with an analogy, and I said, if you were sitting on the Titanic in 1912 and you had 48 hours warning, if somebody came up to you and said, this ship is steaming at 23 knots into an ice field 5,000 square miles in size and is going to hit an iceberg and sink in 2 hours and 20 minutes, could you have saved yourself based upon what you know today? Now, nearly everybody that I talk to says to me, well, of course I could. I read the book and I saw the movie. I know exactly what to do to save myself, whether I'm a man, woman, or child off of the Titanic, 800 survivors and 1,500 victims. Now, of course, at the time, nobody knew what was going to happen. And after it happened, most people did not know what had happened until it was too late to do anything about it. Now, we're facing a geopolitical crisis here in the world. $50 a barrel of oil has a cause. Now, oil back in the early 1900s was $2.73 a barrel priced in oil. Priced in gold. The oil was priced in gold. So there was a gold-oil ratio of $2.73 a barrel. Today it's up over $50 a barrel. Well, inflation comes into play because today the dollar is worth about 5 cents as to what it was worth back in the early part of the century. So we've lost 95% of the value. Nor put another way, you'd have to move that price up by about 20 times. So take $2.73 a barrel to 73 times 20. Actually, it's times 19. And it's $51.87 a barrel. So the price of oil at $51.87 a barrel is just about what it was in 1907 when this ratio of $2.73 a barrel priced in gold became the standard by which gold and oil or money and oil was valued. So when I see oil at $51.87 a barrel, I'm saying, well, it's been that way forever, adjusted for inflation. So what's there to get excited about? Well, today there's less and less oil available, and the only reason that we're able to price oil as low as $51.87 a barrel is because we've been finding as much as we need to use. In other words, when we were running out of whale oil back in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, there was a real concern. What are we going to substitute it with? Fortunately, we came up with petroleum. Now, coal can also be turned into liquid fuel. I don't know if you're aware of this, but I'll just pass it on. The Germans liquefied coal and made aviation fuel out of it. They also took their potato crop in 1944 and turned that into aviation fuel. And of course, just because you can do it doesn't mean that it's economical. I did a series here. We were talking about peak oil and biodiesel and things like that. Well, this biodiesel, if you take it from soybeans, costs $4 plus a gallon. Well, that isn't very economical. You know, if you can buy diesel, petroleum diesel for $2 a gallon, but you can burn soybean oil for $4 a gallon, well, okay, so it costs you twice as much. That's equivalent to $100 a barrel, you know, for oil today. Well, we just assume not have to spend twice as much on that product. And of course, our industrial society today traces its phenomenal growth over the past 100 years to this cheap fuel called oil. Well, we're running out of the stuff, or at least many people tell us that we're running out of the stuff. And of course, this listener called in and he said, well, listen, Gordon, you know, I agree with you. You got some good points here, but you've been deceived here by the government men and by the oil industry because they're overestimating the reserves. And I think I pointed this out, that the world has been running out of oil for 100 years. And of course, as a marketing strategy, you don't want to tell people that there's an endless supply of this product. Because if there's an endless supply of the product, then it isn't worth as much. But if people believe that this stuff is in short supply and hard to get a hold of, well, then it's worth more money. So one of the reasons that we want to keep this perpetual, the world is running out of oil, psychology going is for marketing reasons. I mean, I'm a businessman, and I'm smart enough to know that we want to have a shortage or the threat of a shortage. Take a look at milk moving up to $4 a gallon because of a shortage. Now, it doesn't make any difference what causes the shortage. It could be government interference, government regulations, inflation. It could be government policy. It could be somebody else's policy. It could be people that don't want to drink milk. It can be a bad product. And it's 55 reasons why prices move up and down. And the moral to my story is that there is a concept out there, used to be, it's not there anymore, but a concept called the free market. And in the free market, if we just leave people alone to buy, sell, and trade, there will be a product produced at a price. And then, of course, when this product gets out there at a price, there's people that want to compete and people that want to control the market and want to make greater profits off of it. So when we were producing oil at $2.73 a barrel, somebody came up and said, well, let's not use gold, let's use paper. And then by the 1970s, when this paper had inflated, and the Arabs were still selling their oil for $2.73, but they were selling it in dollars that had half the purchasing power of gold at $2.73 a barrel, they wanted to raise the price. Selfish Arabs that they are. Just because we were screwing them out of half the value of their oil, they got uppity about it. You know, people are like that. So today, when you look at oil at $51.87 a barrel, just keep in mind that the price of oil has not gone up in 100 years. So the reason that we're running out of oil is because we're using way more of it. For instance, oil is being used at the rate of about 5% per year more. So it means that the consumption of oil doubles every 15 years. And as long as the stuff is cheap, why shouldn't we use more of it? And oil is a good lubricant, but coal isn't nearly as good. So it would seem like to me that we ought to burn more coal in power plants and no oil at all. For instance, I don't think that burning oil in a power plant to make electricity makes any sense at all. It makes sense because the electricity sells at a profit even though we burn oil. And burning oil to heat your homes, I don't think makes any sense at all. Because that oil is needed in another place. For instance, you can heat your house with coal, wood, natural gas, but you can't run a truck on coal or natural gas or wood. Now, there's some exceptions to that, I know, but I'm just telling you that for practical purposes, you know, the thing to do, in my view, is to burn wood to heat your house. Now, that's what I do here. I live out in the country, and I don't want to pay the exceptional cost. It cost me about $1,000 a year. This year, they're telling me it would have cost me $1,200 to heat my house. I got a bigger house than average, so it actually costs more than that. But $1,200 to heat my house with propane. Now, I burn wood, so I burn about 4 or 5 cords of wood here a year. Got a big house. And I can produce that wood here on my own farm for my labor that goes into it. So when I go out and make 4 or 5 cords of wood, it takes me about 4 or 5 days. I'm getting to be an old man now. I'm pretty slow. I used to do 2 cords of wood a day. Now I can only do about 1. So it takes me about 5 days. But if you take that $1,200 and you divide that by the 5 cords, that's $240 per cord. Now, I can buy wood here all day long for $100 a cord. Now, I don't even buy the wood. I go out and make it myself, and so the wood's free. It just takes my labor, and my labor isn't worth anything because I'm an old man, should be retired on Social Security. So I make $240 a cord for making the wood and save $1,200 in cash. Economically, that makes all the sense in the world. Furthermore, I'm not consuming that propane. I'm leaving that propane that I would be consuming out in the marketplace. So there's more for you people to divide up among yourselves. And my idea is that if more and more people thought like I do, I'm thinking about the environment and thinking about the other people and saying, well, why don't I burn wood and the rest of you people, you know, can burn propane, natural gas or something else. Now, since there's a limited supply and we know that we've got about another 50-year supply of oil. Now, that's what we're being told, and with all due respect to you, Tate, I get my numbers and facts and figures from prestigious sources, you know, like the National Geographic. If you'll remember, I was citing from the National Geographic. Yeah, I don't know if they're right or wrong, but you see, maybe you're right and they're wrong, or maybe they're right and you're wrong, or maybe there's a combination of the two. And so for the benefit of all of you listeners out there, whenever somebody says left and the next guy says right, well, it could well be that the center over here is straight ahead. So there's a little truth on the right and a little truth on the left, and maybe there's a greater volume of truth or more. There's more for us here in the center, so I don't want to be an extremist in either direction. But I think everybody would agree that at some point in time we're going to run out of oil, that it's a finite resource. It isn't like air, you know, or oxygen in the air, which is being reproduced with every tree. And it's there and it's being reproduced constantly. You know, I can go out here and plant seeds in my garden and produce carrots, and then I can eat those carrots, and then I can get seeds off the carrots and plant them back in the garden next year. I have an endless supply of carrots. Well, we can't quite do that with oil, coal, and some of these fossil fuels, you know, that run out. Now, it's been estimated that we've got more than 1,000 years of coal. So we Americans are pretty well blessed. God gave us the coal and gave the Arabs the oil. Furthermore, I mentioned to you that we have about 4 trillion barrels, you know, give or take a trillion, but there's about 4 trillion barrels of oil, the liquid stuff that you can run trucks on and then cars. That's in oil shale, but it costs more to dig it out than it does that cheap, easy fuel in the Middle East. And I pointed out that as long as there's a barrel of oil left, we're not going to make oil out of oil shale. So I'm not as pessimistic about this whole oil problem, because we do have something to fall back on. And you see, when the whales are finally all killed off, we're not going to freeze in the dark, because we're going to drill for oil and get oil out of the ground. And when the oil out of the ground, we pump out that last barrel of oil, the end of the world isn't going to come, because we've still got that oil shale out there. And even if we didn't have the oil shale out there, you know, before we were drilling in the ground for oil, we were burning wood and coal, and we can do the same again. Now, Tate points out in this article here that there's a number of other sources of energy, such as nuclear, and they analyze nuclear energy, and I raised that issue myself. I said, you know, I think we should be producing more nuclear energy. And on every debate, or in every debate, there's two sides. And on the one side, you've got the nuclear people, and they're like, you know, if we had more nuclear energy over here, why, we'd consume less oil and less coal, and we'd pollute the air less. Let me tell you something. I just saw this the other day. There's three key states in the East: Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Now, those three states produce a lot of coal. Neither presidential candidate is talking, at least in those three battleground states, as I speak here before the election. Nobody is telling those people that we need more nuclear power and less coal so we don't pollute the air. Now, east of the Mississippi River, we have this acid rain. And this acid rain is caused by all this coal that we're burning to generate electricity, killing off trees in the east. Whole forests are dying. And it pollutes the lakes. You know, now I don't care whether you're a coal miner or not. If you're polluting the lakes and killing the trees, doesn't common sense tell you that at some point in time, you have to stop doing that? Because if you continue on, there won't be a tree left alive east of the Mississippi River. Now, do you think that would be good? Of course, for you coal miners living underground, you don't see trees anyway, and you don't care, but the rest of us do. So my common sense says that we should burn less coal. And I don't think we should replace that with liquid oil. I think that'd be better served burning in diesel trucks or something else. So then that leaves electric energy, and then you've got these conservationists say we want to tear down all the dams so that the fish can swim up the rivers. Now, come on guys, and that's evolutionary philosophy. And what they're telling you here is these evolutionists are that these fish over here have the same rights as human beings. Now, when God created the earth, see, I'm one of these creationists, God created the earth, he gave us the animals, gave us the earth, and he said subdue it, and that's ours, it's ours to do with. Now, he said, he gave us one more instruction, he said dress it and keep it. So we ought to take care of it. And I don't think we should be burning coal, creating acid rain, and destroying the forests. Doesn't make any sense to me. But I mentioned this in my last series of programs, that the environmentalists don't have a solution. What they're telling us is tear down all the dams, but they don't tell us, well, what are you going to replace that hydroelectric power with? What the hell are we going to do, freeze in the dark? They say, well, we're not going to drill for any more oil. Okay, well, what are we going to run our cars on? Well, we're not going to drive anymore. Oh, well, how are we going to get to work? And what about all of the businesses and the industries that depend upon tourists who have to burn gasoline in their cars to get from here to there? I mean, you know, these environmentalists are quick to say, well, we've got to change our way of life, and I think they're right. But do we have to kill ourselves in the process? And I think that rational people should not only point to the problem, they should also come up with the, or at least a, solution. Now, you've got this oil crash coming. Okay. We need a solution to this oil crash, don't we? So I've got one. Here, where I live on this farm, I'm prepared to pay $50 a gallon for gasoline. $50 a gallon. Now, obviously, I'm not going to be running my motorhome, you know, at 6 miles to the gallon, at least not very far. But I kind of like labor-saving devices. I'm not quite like the Amish yet, so I don't mind gasoline engines, and I've got a rototiller and some chainsaws. Now, I got to go out and make 5 cords of wood. Now, if I had to go out and make 5 cords of wood with a bow saw, you know, that'd be a cold day in hell. But with a chainsaw, I can go out and make a cord of wood in about a day, load it up in my truck, and haul it back. So at $50 a gallon, I can still make my wood here. I won't quite make it free, and it'll have a little more cost to it, but I can still heat my house, so I'm not going to freeze in the dark. and $50 a gallon. Hell, maybe even at $100 a gallon, I might be able to make it all right. And so I'm sitting here saying, well, if I can do that, well, then you can do that. Now, you got these big cities. Take Dallas, Texas. Down in Dallas, Texas, they've got big office buildings with glass windows. Not exactly the most energy efficient, but of course they're pretty far south, and it doesn't get as cold down there as it does up, say, in Winnipeg, Canada, or in Waterloo, Iowa. So, moral to the story is, don't you think that from now on that we Americans ought to get used to higher and higher oil prices and let the marketplace regulate the use and the consumption of oil? For instance, you know, if oil goes up to $4 a gallon, it'll make soybean oil competitive with diesel. And at the same time, the marketplace will say to us that if oil is $4 a gallon, then we ought to use less of it. You're never going to get people to stop using Humvees and low mileage cars as long as the price of oil is the same as it was in 1907. In other words, when things get into short supply, you've got to raise the price to dampen demand. That's just economics 101. Now, I know we don't want to do that and we don't want to face reality, but my point is that we've got to have a solution. And if you're going to have a solution, you got to know what the problem is. Now, I got to take a break here in a few seconds, and we'll come back and we'll take a look at this oil crash and you, and let's talk about it with solutions in mind. Not just problems now, but let's talk about what do you do to solve that problem. Hang on, I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependence, incompetence, incapacity. We've been made wards of powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions of our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals like bankers to manage our financial affairs, or doctors to manage and treat our health problems, and lawyers to direct our business and legal affairs instead of relying upon our own good common sense. That's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish instead of being fed by these paid professionals. Regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, rights, liberties, and duties. Now, to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? It's educational, informative, entertaining, and it's free. So why don't you call right now and order yours? It's 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request. That's georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the oil crash and you, and I mentioned that the presidential candidates now aren't criticizing the consumption or the burning of oil because they want the votes from those people in the swing states that produce coal. I say that's hypocrisy. George Bush, at least, is willing to touch the third rail of politics called Social Security, because remember, Social Security is going bankrupt again. It's a Ponzi scheme that works geometrically in the wrong direction, and so ultimately the thing's going to go bankrupt. Alan Greenspan warned us of that. But the both political candidates are telling us, but we're not going to cut benefits, raise the tax, or tamper with it in any way. Oh, well, then what they're telling us is that we got a problem with it and it's insolvent, but we're not going to fix it because that would make all you people mad. And I'm a little more pragmatic as a businessman. I can readily see now I'm old enough to draw Social Security. I paid in. I'm not drawing it. I'm leaving the money there for somebody else. I don't need it, number one. I don't want it, number two, and I don't want it forced upon me, number three. So I'm going to opt out of Social Security altogether. And I'm suggesting that a lot of the rest of you opt out of Social Security because there are some people out there that really need it. I don't. And there's a lot of you out there that don't need it and you ought not to take it. First of all, it's the mark of the beast, number one. Number two, it's a welfare scheme and you ought to be ashamed to take it. Number two, because it's welfare. Now, we Americans used to believe that. Today, if you don't take it, you're some kind of a fool. So people look at me and they shake their heads and say, you know, you're some kind of a nut not taking your Social Security. Well, there's going to be a lot of people out there that are going to need it one of these days, and since I don't, why don't I leave it there for somebody that needs it? Now, we're talking about the oil crash and you, and this document reveals that within 10 years, now this is 2004, so by the year 2014, oil extraction from wells will be physically unable to meet global demand, and the evidence is from the oil industry itself. Alternative energy sources like nuclear and natural gas will fall far short of compensating for expected shortages of oil, and there is simply not enough time to convert over to them. I want to take exception to that. And that's what they were telling us when we were running out of whales. There isn't enough time to shift over. Now, you're right. If you're going to let the government manage this crisis, then you're going to have a crisis with shortages and lines. That's what you had in 1973 and 78. And every time government interferes in the marketplace, you have shortages, you have depressions and recessions. Government ought not to be involved in the economy at all. And yet most voters, over half, are saying the economy is their number one concern that they want their politicians to solve. Prior to Franklin Roosevelt in 1932, we didn't expect government to solve that problem. Prior to 1935 with Roosevelt, we didn't expect government to provide old age retirement or Social Security. Now, if you want to become dependent upon Social Security or dependent upon government, I think that you're going to be bitterly disappointed at some point in time. But again, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. If you think that's the way to go, why don't you give it a whirl? Give it a try. I'm going to opt out. I'm going to opt out of Social Security, then I won't be disappointed. I'm going to opt out of this oil dependence. And in fact, I'm working as hard as I can to become totally oil independent. I don't want to be dependent upon oil at all. And I'm in the process now of putting in my own solar power plant. I think that I should stop consuming electricity that the rest of you people out there probably need. I'll let you take my share that I'm taking off the grid today and let you divide that up. I think ultimately it's going to lead you to sorrow, but then, you know, that's your choice in life. Now listen here, he says, massive disruptions to transportation and the economy are expected around the year 2010, when the final peak of production of all petroleum liquids globally is followed by a decline, and the decline is expected to be approximately 3% a year. So if oil is $51 today, adjusted for inflation over the next 10 years, and remember that if inflation continues at 5% a year, which is where it's at today or more, in 15 years, it's going to double. So the price of oil should be around $100 a barrel about the year 2010, adjusted for inflation. Now, gradual permanent cutoff of fuel for transportation and for industrial machinery, global trade will greatly decline. Well, then global employment will greatly decline also, won't it? So then my common sense says, well, gee, do I want to be dependent upon employment in some industry that's dependent upon petroleum? And the answer to that is no, so maybe I better come up with a different solution. Agriculture, food production, depends heavily on fertilizers, and those fertilizers are made from oil. Well, now maybe what we should do is concentrate on developing a system of agriculture that is not dependent upon petroleum fertilizer. Well, let me go back here for a second and let's take a look. When God developed this agricultural system back at the Garden of Eden, I don't see anything in the Bible that tells us to go to DuPont or OrthoGrow or Standard Oil or Exxon to get our chemical fertilizers. And in fact, chemical fertilizers produce insects. Insects consume your crops, and then we have to have more petrochemicals to make poison sprays, which in turn then pollute our streams, rivers, and create a lot of cancer and heartache, and wouldn't we be better off without it? My conclusion is yes, so I have an organic farm, and we don't use any chemical fertilizers at all. None. Zero. No pesticides. Now, that's kind of an oddity here. We burn wood, and we're trying to become energy independent. Now, I'm suggesting that we do this all over the nation. Now, we did this 100 years ago. People were not petroleum dependent, and they weren't dependent upon chemical fertilizers, and we were feeding ourselves. Now, why don't we get back to doing that again? It's called Land Sabbaths and Jubilees in the Bible. There's an agricultural system with 15 agricultural laws. I've discovered that if you practice those agricultural laws, you don't need these chemical fertilizers and sprays. Well, that's my conclusion. We didn't need them in 1900. And there are about, I think there's around 4,000 of these little economic units, I've mentioned this before, making $100,000 a year organically, and they're doing it without chemical sprays and fertilizers and getting a premium price from people that don't want produce that are sprayed and chemically grown. So I haven't found anybody that has said that there's anything wrong with organic produce, but I have seen some people complain about chemical produce. So we could save a tremendous amount of this petroleum if we just get off of these chemicals in agriculture. So that's a little job for our extension services and our agricultural colleges, don't you think? Re-education. Now, shortages of 500,000 other goods made from oil. Now, there's a lot of things like plastics that are made from oil. Now, the plastics are pretty good little things. Now, of course, we can live without plastic, and we did 100 years ago. Before somebody invented plastic, we were living without it. And life might be a lot better with it. So why don't we keep the plastics and the 500,000 things that we make with these plastics? And let's start burning more wood and coal to heat our houses. And maybe instead of burning up all that natural gas and flaring it off, maybe we ought to concentrate and see if we can't get more of it to market and use it. Now, as the marketplace brings the price of natural gas and propane higher and higher, then we're going to have to be a little more circumspect about the way we use it, aren't we? And he goes on to say, therefore, reduction of virtually all business and government activity. So there's going to be some reductions. Now, what are we going to replace these reductions with? So if you're going to reduce your use of chemical fertilizers and sprays, well, then those industries that produce those chemical fertilizers and sprays have to come up with something else for those people to work at. Let me back up here a little bit. We Americans produce more per man on our farms than anybody else in the world, but we do it with 600 horsepower. The average American farmer has 600 horsepower working for him to produce what he produces. But we don't produce more per acre. The guy that gets that credit is the Egyptian farmer in the Nile Valley. He gets more production per acre than anybody else in the world. Now, the Rodale people in Pennsylvania discovered that with French intensive culture and organic production, they could produce $28,000 worth of produce on one-third of an acre. Did you get that? Now, that's an experimental plot, and that's not average production. That's the peak. That's the Guinness Book of Records. 28,000 times 3 is $84,000 an acre. Now, I've mentioned to you that there are people that are producing $100,000 on as little as 3 acres per year. Now, don't you think that we could produce more on smaller acreages rather than these humongous corporate farms? Now, they tested this in the Soviet Union with all of these big communal properties. They took the little farms away from people, and they turned them into these big communal farms, big corporate agribusiness institutions. And the Russians discovered that they were producing half of their food on these big multi-thousand-acre state-run farms, and the other half of their food was coming from the one-half acre that they allowed the peasants on these big communal farms to produce. Think of that. Now, if we Americans are producing less and less per acre and more per man with more and more horsepower, those 600 horsepower consume a lot of diesel fuel. Now, let me give you another factor, another figure here, maybe you hadn't heard of. The American farmer expends more energy producing his crops than the crops themselves are worth. Let me repeat that. Here in America, when a farmer goes out in the field with his 600 horsepower and his thousands of gallons of diesel fuel, in calculating the heat energy that comes out of the soybeans and the heat energy that goes into producing the soybeans, we Americans produce less than we consume in the production of our agricultural products. In other words, if we didn't have diesel fuel, we would all starve to death in this country. So right away, my common sense says that, well, you know, before there was diesel fuel, there was life. Now, the Amish people are still able to produce. In fact, the Amish are the only people that can produce corn at $1 a bushel and make a profit. Nobody else can do that. Now, I'm sure the Amish don't want to produce corn at $1 a bushel, but I'm pointing out that when you take the tractors out and you take the diesel fuel out and the expenses and repairs over there, you know, there's profit to be made in agriculture. In fact, you can make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less, and a lot of you farmers out there aren't making that kind of money. So instead of hiring all these people to make chemical fertilizers so that we can take all the little farms of 25 acres and put them into one or two or five big farms so that we can become more and more, well, I should put it, less and less efficient, more and more consumptive, but less and less efficient, I think, is counterproductive. So maybe our agricultural colleges need to go back and re-educate us. Now, I was educated in the Future Farmers of America. I'm an ag school man, and I read Plowman's Folly one day, and I said, wait a minute, this is crazy. This is insane. I changed my farming practices. I think that we need more and more people in agriculture, not fewer and fewer. I think we need more and more smaller farms producing organic produce, and that the people that are working in those chemical factories producing the chemical fertilizers, which you have to have for these gigantic farming operations. I had a farmer in here one time. He said to me that he farms 15 sections. I don't know if many of you people grasp the significance of that, but I'm an old-timey farmer, and I used to farm with a John Deere D model tractor built in 1947. Iron wheeler, remember those? Some of you old guys. Listen, when we went out and farmed 20 acres with a John Deere D, I'm telling you, it took you 30 days to plow it and break up the clods and get that thing ready and seeded. 30 days with a D model. This guy is farming every year 15 sections. Now, a section 640 acres. That's a mile square. You get in your car and you drive a mile and you turn right. And you drive a mile and you turn right. And you drive a mile and you turn right. And you drive to where you started. That's a section 640 acres times 15 of those is 9,600 acres. Divided by 20. It would take 480 farmers on 20 acres with 480 John Deere D model tractors built in 1947 to farm 9,600 acres. This guy does it every year by himself. Well, not by himself. He probably got a bunch of hired men, 6 or 8 or 10 tractors and a lot of equipment, burns a lot of diesel, and then the amount of wheat that he gets off of that 9,600 acres equals less BTUs than the input. Now, that's not efficiency, and that doesn't make any sense, and that's predicated upon all this cheap oil at $2.73 a barrel, which we're running out of. So at some point in time, we've all got to make some hard, fast decisions. And I contend that the government ought not to be making those decisions at all. Now, Al Gore wrote a book here back before 2000 election, and, you know, he's talking about government solutions. And what these socialists and communists have in mind is more and more power. Give that power over to us in the government, and let us solve your problem for you. Let us do that. No, the government is the cause of the problem, not the solution. If you want somebody to blame for this oil crash or this oil crisis, blame governments. Blame the government's taxation. Blame the government and its environmental rules and all of the OSHAs and EPAs. If you leave the marketplace alone, boys and girls, the marketplace just works like a shot. It's called the free market economy. And when you interfere with it, the government interferes with the free market economy for profit and gain. They try to create monopolies. See, in America, we had 2,000 car companies. Today, we've got three. And one of the three is owned by a German company, Dodge. Remember Chrysler? Plymouth, Dodge, that's now owned by a German outfit. We've only got two American car companies left. And that's what monopoly is all about. Now, if we leave the marketplace alone and let people produce automobiles, then you'd have four car companies and then eight and 16 and 32, and you'd have some real competition. Same thing is true in drilling for oil. There's lots of oil out there, and we can stretch it out a lot further, but you got to spend money and go look for it, and it's a monopoly. And the only companies that can afford the environmental impact statements are the big multinational companies. You and I cannot go out and dig or drill for oil. We're locked out of the free market. There is a closed market system. The petroleum industry is a monopoly. It's a monopoly that is regulated by government, and there's about 10 multinational players like Shell, Exxon, Texaco, and so on. And these players are the only people that can drill for oil. And the only oil they're looking for is the easy oil and lots of it. And they're the only guys that can drill in 20,000 feet of water or 10,000 feet of water out in the Gulf of Mexico. I'll concede that. But there's lots of oil here on land that farmers could be looking for. In fact, let me tell you a little story here. I was up in Pennsylvania one day, and this guy was running his entire factory off of natural gas. Natural gas. And here's the surprising part of it. The natural gas was produced by his own well, a methane well that was drilled down into the coal seams underneath his factory. He'd been operating his factory for 15 years, never spent a dime on energy outside of his factory. Well, listen, there's factories all over Pennsylvania that could do the same thing. I mentioned geothermal, produced by PG&E. Well, listen, there's probably lots of people that could produce geothermal energy if there was a free marketplace, but you can't do anything that there isn't some government bureaucracy somewhere that has to license, bond, and insure you to do anything. So people, entrepreneurs like George Gordon are locked out. We can't do it anyway. So the people like George Gordon sit back and say, well, look, the rest of you fools can freeze in the dark in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles for all I care. So I'm out here taking care of George Gordon, and you people in the cities have been converted to socialism and communism, and you're waiting for George Bush or John Kerry to solve your problems. This isn't a problem going to be solved by government. If anybody's going to solve this problem, you're going to solve it, and you're going to solve it for yourself. If you think you can solve that in downtown Chicago, out around the loop, well, get at it. Get after it. I think you're going to, as the old saying goes, do it and fall back in it. That's my conclusion. These cities are becoming less and less able to support themselves. In fact, there's a study been done that once a city reaches a million population, anything over a million, the city becomes unsustainable. So the city can't sustain itself. It has to be sustained from those on the outside. So the Democrats come in. Take a look now at your election results. And you'll see that in the major Democratic states like California, Washington, Oregon, New York, Florida, these are states that are unsustainable. They have big metropolitan populations like Miami, Dade County, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and so on. And these big cities, these multi-million population cities, have to be supported and sustained by the rural taxpayers out in society, out here in the real world. Now, you take a look at the people that are paying the taxes and supporting the big cities. The people that are the actual producers are the ones that are rebelling against and supporting the Republicans. They're rebelling against taxes and supporting the Republicans. And the Democrats are coming along, and they're saying, well, let's have more taxes. Who are you going to tax? We're going to tax the rich. Oh, come on. Wait a minute. The rich are the last people in the world to pay taxes. I pointed that out on this program time and time again. The only people that pay taxes are the poor and the middle class. And the richer you are, the less tax you're going to pay. That's because you're smart enough to shelter it, and that's because you're smart enough, if you're rich, that you support Kissinger Associates and you lobby in the Congress to get tax loopholes built into the law. And so let's forget about taxing the rich. That ain't going to happen. And every time you tax business, that just passes the cost on to you, the consumer. So go ahead and pass a tax and tax McDonald's because they're rich. And they'll just add a nickel onto the price of a hamburger, and you'll pay it down here at the lower end working for minimum wage of $5.25 an hour. So if you want to raise your taxes, tax General Motors. Tax IBM and Microsoft and see what happens to you. So that ain't going to happen. Now, and I said that what we need are some solutions. The environmentalists come along and say what we need to do is to tear down all the dams on the Columbia River. I don't know if you've heard that story or not, but I don't know which environmentalists are calling for this, but I've read several articles on it, and I imagine all the environmentalists are saying, tear down all the dams. Listen, those dams produce a lot of electricity. I forgot what the percentage is now in the Pacific Northwest, but there's about six or eight dams up the Columbia River. And I would say that at this juncture of time, reaching peak oil, you know, with your fingernails hanging on the cliff of recession, the last thing you want to do is be talking about tearing down the infrastructure that maintains your system and your society. You got to have something to replace the electricity that you're going to disrupt by tearing down the Grand Coulee Dam, don't you think? That's the thing that makes me so disappointed about these ecologists and greenies, and then the thing that probably, in the minds of most people, gives them so little respect and so little credibility. They don't have a solution. After you tear the dams down, then what are you going to replace it with? Well, let's use solar energy. Have you been out here pricing solar panels? I have. It's going to cost me $40,000, $40,000 inflated dollars to put in an electric power plant using solar panels. And it's just getting to the point today where it's going to be economically feasible to do that. Well, look, we've got to take a break here. I'm just about out of time for this hour. We'll continue on with this. I'm doing a series of programs here on Tate, who sent me a neat article here, The Oil Crash and You. And let's talk about some meaningful solutions. Things that you can do personally, things that I'm going to do personally to solve my problem with the oil crash, because I'm just like you. I don't care where you live or what you do for a living. I got the same problem that you got, and the difference is I've got a solution for it, and I'm going to share that solution with you. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, biblical law, all from the scriptural perspective. And the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio logs, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. All right, there's the signal. Says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about the oil crash and you. So until then, good night, friends.